Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Decade Project on One Heat Minute Productions. Patreon, first up, but later in the year, if you're listening to this in 2024, you're going to be hearing it on the main feed. This was a weird project that I just said, what if I went back 10 years ago and saw the movies that actually still hung around and resonated? And I think in the world that we live in right now, it feels like that's as far back as our streamers want to go. They don't want to go any further back than 10 years for whatever reason. And I feel like we're just, there's such a glut of content that anything that's still hanging around in our consciousness is so worthwhile to talk about. This is a fun one because it's so rare that I'm talking about a film from 10 years ago in 2014, as we do Decade Projects. We, in this year, 2024, cover everything in 2014. Next year, covering all of our favorites from 2015. But it's so rare that I get to talk about a film that was made 10 years ago and a filmmaker is making and releasing, and literally their new release film is coming out as I'm recording this and I've recently seen it. The film that I'm talking to today is, strangely, last year, there seemed to be a run of these movies that were Frankenstein adjacent movies, whether it's Poor Things or Barbie. But 10 years ago in 2014, the great screenwriter behind things like 28 Days Later and Sunshine, and the great filmmaker in his own right, Alex Garland, made maybe his best film. The film is Ex Machina. And my terrific guest is the host of the Bright Wall Dark Room podcast. And I've been dying to say this. The professor is here. Veronica Fitzpatrick, thank you so much for being a part of the Decade Project. Welcome back. And can I say, the title of your great essay from a long time ago, Can I Fuck This? Alex Garland's Ex Machina is just firstly great. The essay is sensational, but thank you so much for coming back and revisiting this film with me from 2014, a film I absolutely know has had some staying power and has really been like a sleeper for a lot of, I know, people in our mutual community. So thank you so much for joining me to talk about Alex Garland's Ex Machina.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, the doctor is in.
The doctor is in. I'm so excited to say that. Can't tell you how much.
You are dead center of the greatest scientific event in the history of man.
Hello.
How do you feel about her?
She's amazing.
Every cell phone has a microphone, camera, and a means to transmit data. So I turned on every microphone and camera across the entire planet. And I redirected the data through Blue Book. My competitors thought that search engines were a map of what people were thinking, but actually they were a map of how people were thinking.
Did you know that Nathan brought me here to test you?
You're wrong.
Wrong about what?
Nathan, you shouldn't trust anything he says.
Does Ava actually like you, or is she just pretending to like you? Self-awareness, manipulation, sexuality.
Are you attracted to me?
Now, if that isn't true AI, what is?
Caleb, there's something I want to show you. To me if I fail your test.
Let's go back. 10 years ago, Ex Machina is released. It's kind of one of those year bridging movies. Some people are going to tell me, Blake, Ex Machina wasn't released in 2014. Widely, it was released in 2015. Guys, I'm sorry. It just is what it is with our show. Sometimes there are these movies that bridge. You know, last year, there was Only Lovers Left Alive, which I saw in Australia in 2013, and folks were like, no, it didn't get wide. I'm sorry, it is what it is. But at the time, it had a tremendous response critically. There were so many effusive and very positive reviews of the film all across, you know, even if you do the sort of top critic snapshot, you know, friend of the show, Jason Bailey, cracking good entertainment, brainy science fiction picture executed in clean, concise style with a narrative as logical as it is unpredictable. I think that's a beautiful little summation. So many others, which we'll talk about. Veronica, can you tell me, when did you see it and what was your first experience of it?
Yeah, I believe I saw it in 2014, though looking back, I guess I'm entirely not sure, but I know I saw it in the cinema. I'm a huge Sunshine fan. Yeah. So I was really excited about this movie. And then I can't remember if this is like before Black Mirror. It is, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe. Just, must be Just, yes.
Yeah. So this is a kind of like world that I would always gravitate toward. This sense of humanoid or like liminal in their ontology, kind of like robot women or like, you know, what exactly is it? It's adjacent to humanity in some way, that kind of thing. Speculative science fiction. And I was really excited about the casting. This is really like before A24 was its own like self-parodying motor.
Before it became people's identity.
Yeah, exactly. Before people were like, this distribution company is it. Yeah, but it was a huge part of that. Like, I remember watching it in the cinema, and probably this and Under the Skin, which is about the same time, I had really analogous relationships too.
Can we just pause quickly? Under the Skin is a movie. I'm gonna bring up some of the details to find out exactly when this was. This I was watching Under the Skin at the time, which is a 2013 film.
Yeah,
incredible film. Again, one of those weird ones that's a bridge. And there's another film right around this time as well called The Skin I Live In from 2011, which feels like this is in the family. Pedro Almodovar's film with Antonio Banderas and Elena Anaya. And I remember coming home from seeing The Skin I Live In much the same way that I did Under the Skin or Ex Machina. And I just came home, and at the time I was still smoking, and I literally came home and I walked in the door. I picked up a cigarette. I went out in the back of my balcony and had a cigarette and a drink. And I was like, holy shit. This, like, that was a movie. That was a movie, ladies and gentlemen. That's why you go to the movies, to just have really weird, fucked up, ambivalent experiences. That was a really great thing. So yeah, in that sort of sequence of events, I was like, this is a great little patch, that whatever that weird thing is. I love you said liminal ontology is such a great phrase. That's good.
Well, it's exactly like the review that you quoted, the sense of like a narrative that is simultaneously logical and unpredictable.
Yes.
And you just feel sort of secure as a viewer that what is unfolding before you is like really composed, but is also designed to sort of keep you in suspense in a meaningful way. And I think really good genre pictures, I mean, that's the bread and butter. And all three of those movies are Can I Fuck This movies. So
absolutely.
It was a powerful, powerful subgenre at this point in time.
Tell you what, an imprint box set. Let's go. Get some physical media outlet needs to sort that. That's amazing. So you saw it back then at the cinema. What was your experience? You come, you catch it in the theater. You're feeling secure. At what point, like, is it all the way to the crescendo that you're crazy for it? Because I feel like last night I had a very similar experience actually to my first cinematic experience. And I've watched this movie a bunch of times, but just like everything about, as you said, the composition and this, I don't want to say glacial in a derogatory way. I want to say this glacial, steady pacing was so great. And then there's just a moment where, you know, the stars of the movie are obviously Oscar Isaac and Domhnall Gleeson and Alicia Vikander. And there's a moment where Domhnall Gleeson's character is standing in a room at Caleb interviewing Ava, the AI subject in question in their Turing test. And the cameras in Nathan Oscar Isaac's compound turn off. We start to get a little bit more information about why they are turning off as the film progresses. They turn off, and in the middle of this very kind of innocuous second session where Ava seems to be getting to know Caleb, the red lights of this generator rebooting turn on. The camera angles change from this very steady, stabilized, mid shots into these weird, crazy Dutch angles or claustrophobic close-ups. And Ava's like, he is not your friend. And in that moment, I was like, I don't know what's going to happen. And the first time I watched the movie, I knew obviously last night, but I'm like, I'm going to love this movie. Like in that moment, I was like, this is the moment that I'm going to love it. And I wonder, did you have a similar experience? Was there sort of a moment where you were like, oh no, this is right in my wheelhouse?
Oh, that's such a great question. I mean, I think probably when Caleb arrives at the Blue Book compound for the first time. And I can't remember what European country that's an actual location.
It's like Greenland or Iceland or something like that. It's
maybe Iceland. It's definitely a hotel that one can stay in, that kind of like hybrid. Really? Yeah. Glassed into rock kind of thing. And I mean, I loved, like, right away from that, I feel like you can see that the film is interested, even on the level of the mise-en-scene, in this composite of like natural and manufactured and kind of something organic and something really cold. And we're going to be kind of shuttling between those poles throughout the film narratively as well as stylistically. But it was so cool to see the space reflect that right away. And from that point forward, I was probably like, okay, like this has been pretty thought out, and I love that.
someone's taken a real lot of time to make this happen.
Yeah.
Obviously, all the big sweeping scale, and then you get to a bunker, like it's offset by these beautiful, like I love that the location, because it like bleeds into the trees, like it's
right.
when you go outside, and then when you get back in, cold, stark, hard angles. Thick concrete, you know, glass, all this frosted glass everywhere. So there's no way to look in or out. It's very special. So you saw it at the time and had a great response right at that time.
I did. I was writing a dissertation about representations of rape in film, and particularly horror films after 1960. Totally heavy. Fun 9 years.
You gave yourself a real task there. That's not
fair. I know, but I like, the real thing that interested me about it was, I guess, like the cinematic techniques of representation of an experience, the event of which and the recollection of which, or like sharing that information, really evades representation. I mean, it's something only the person who experiences it can convey or know, and then really difficult to evidence. And that difficulty of evidencing is something I love seeing films try to work with. And in this movie, I had this forever can feeling this hunch that
yes.
Even movies, or maybe especially movies, horror movies that take place in apocalyptic situations, or 28 Days Later is a terrific example.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, trafficking in the unreal it to a really like large extent. At the same time, at the end of the day, there's just going to be this very mundane threat of rape kind of threaded into the narrative. Yeah. And then that will ultimately be like the worst part of the movie. In so many zombie narratives, when we finally see like the humans who are alive, they're so scary. And yeah. like they're yeah. the real threat of the movie. And
absolutely.
Everyone since Romero has kind of known this. You know, I think Garland does a great job conveying this in 28 Days Later. And in this movie too, I was like, yeah, this is it. He gives us ostensibly a nice guy and a less nice guy, and then totally like dissolves that boundary. No yeah. guys are nice no. by the end of the day.
And I think I was recently talking to a great filmmaker, a director and an actor, Shari Sebbins, just in a semi-worky social setting, mutual friend of now I can say mutual friend of mine and Maria Lewis, my best mate. And there's a film that Warwick Thornton made. He's an Aussie Indigenous filmmaker called mm-hmm. Sweet Country. And at the beginning of that film, there is a scene where, unfortunately, a rape scene where there's a character who is living on, you know, an Indigenous woman who is living on like a piece of land that a white, you know, farmer, post-war farmer is living on, and he just sort of takes his liberties with her.
Mm.
And the filmmaking is so incredible because Warwick Thornton shoots the entire scene in pitch black.
Mm-hmm.
You do not see it. And I remember Shari, who's also Indigenous, commenting on the fact that, like, Warwick had the wherewithal to know that the omnipresence of sexual violence, especially mm-hmm. in this colonized mm-hmm. country, was so obvious and so traumatic that even though he needed to address it for the storytelling purposes, showing it was not necessary. It mm-hmm. was all simmering underneath there in the darkness that we mm-hmm. knew that that was the threat, and that that was happening, and that had it happened in, you know, the history of our country.
Mm-hmm.
In Australia. And so I also love that there are some other views and ways to do that, where it's like that threat of rape is like there and it's scary. And of course it's awful. It's the worst thing, but it's like, there is a level of trauma sometimes where it's like, we don't have to show this.
Mm-hmm.
It can be just as powerful a thing if we mm-hmm. don't show it and the threat is there. Or if we do show it, it's about that very deliberate, what is my choice in the way to show it, rather than it being exploitative, which it can mm-hmm. be in those kind of grubby, you know, B picture horror movies. Like that's just, it feels,
100%.
It's got a grubby edge, which always is a bit ick. But this movie is fascinating because you actually don't know where the threat is. Like the threat is, that threat is there, but there's just something as we grow into learning about who Ava is that becomes like, who is actually in peril. And mm-hmm. there are lots of little signs and sequences there that do it. But yeah, it had an amazing response. It was I know Alicia Vikander walks away with an Oscar a couple of years later. Donald Gleason's like really kick starting his career. Oscar Isaac, this was one of my favorite performances of his early on because it showed his versatility. Like I think
absolutely
now he's grown into, you know, he's the guy that in this same year is doing things like A Most Violent Year, where it's his like most Pacino performance ever. And then there's this whole other vein of Oscar Isaac, which is like Drive and, you know,
yeah.
Tachina, which are like, he's just kind of got this real manic energy that doesn't feel like the kind of Pacino, you know, next level of Pacino kind of role casting. It's something completely wild and unexpected, including the very gif-able dance, which I think a million people have shared in the 10 years coming.
Can't teach it. Can't teach. He's got it.
He's
a star, baby.
He's a star. Exactly. And Sonoya Mizono as Kyoko, that dance, 20 out of 10. Like, excellent stuff. But I just remember this time, like watching Alicia Vikander go and do some of these other, like, you know, there's that period movie, I don't remember what it was called, that she won an Oscar for. This is a really devalued performance in her career. Like, it's an incredible performance, and it just feels like, oh, because she's kind of a robo chick, like, who cares?
Right,
it's just a genre movie. But it's like, anyone who would diminish the power of that performance is like, is just on another planet to me. She this is her true star making. She is an incredible actor performance.
I totally agree. I think this is the top of her performances for me. And yeah. I think it's really hard to be so beautiful in a role where that's like really one of the main aspects of your character's appeal. And to sell a sense of interiority and intellect at the same time, to be sort of believable. The converse would be that new like three body problem show on Netflix. There's some like female alleged scientist in it, or I don't know, mathematician alleged, or something. Alleged. Every time I see her, I'm just like, there's no fucking way that you're a scientist. Like, you are definitely like a Ford signed model. Just relax. But she just really sells it, and like all these little ticks and the way that she syncs her movement to the purrs of the machinery, I think is really mesmerizing. And maybe like believable, not so much in a that seems like credible AI type of way to me, but more so she really holds her own among these two other really hefty performances from Donald Gleason and Oscar Isaac as the third person and the person with sort of the most mysterious motivations throughout the film.
Yeah, there's, as it's evolving, it's like, again, another funny coincidence. The same year that they release The Imitation Game, which is about Alan Turing, we're watching a gigantic Turing test that's taking place in real time. And the relevance of those two things, or the confluence of those two things coming to reality, it's like you watch The Imitation Game, obviously arousing period drama about you know, this tortured soul who had such a huge influence on, you know, the fate of the fate of World War II, and is then, you know, oppressed because of his sexuality. And then people are talking about the Turing test, and it was like this weird thing of like, shit, this Alan Turing's having a moment in this in this movie, which is kind of funny. But it's this, when Ex Machina comes out, I want to quickly pivot over to Garland for a second, because you said a couple of things. The first thing is, for anyone who had heard of Danny Boyle and gets the luxury of going, all right, we see The Beach, which was kind of like a hot mess, a kind of movie that still is a hot mess from 2000. But then 2002 and then 2007, 28 Days Later and Sunshine, the Boyle Garlands make us a fan of this guy. And then there's a, you know, he writes a screenplay for Never Let Me Go. He writes the screenplay for Dread in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that, no, Alex Garland just directed the whole movie. Like, there's some weird stuff. Mm. I think that's probably hard to figure out with that one. And then Ex Machina comes out and you're like, okay, this guy is a very interesting voice. And since then, so I want to sort of fast forward 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
In the preceding 10 years, after people have made A24 their personality, he writes Annihilation, directs Annihilation, has creates the series Devs, does 2022's Men, which I was like one of those rare people who was kind of in the middle on that movie. There seems to be people who love it and people who detest it. And now has gone all the way up to Civil War. Like, I feel like Garland is a guy who maybe people like you and I are like in the bag for. We're just going to check out what he's doing no matter what. But do you feel like that that's changed since like Men? Is there been like a weird turning point with him as a filmmaker, and now there's like a lot of contention about his new film Civil War, which is coming out, I think probably misunderstood just from marketing more so than actual reception of the movie, but have you felt anything in like hearing his name, like because I think at this time I was like, he's the most exciting science fiction writer filmmaker that we have, and a great voice that's happening, you know, obviously happening from England. And so, like, you have the even the three punch of like, Sunshine, 28 Days Later, and then Ex Machina. I'm like, they are all three fantastic texts that he has had a huge hand in, and I think they're all extremely valuable and great contemporary sci-fis. So yeah, have you felt anything change with him?
That's interesting. I mean, I think the reception of Men was so bad. Yes. That and the especially compared to the anticipation, because it I think, you know, the trailer was pretty juicy.
Yes.
And Jesse Buckley's amazing, and I think Garland is a really great director.
She's going higher.
Yeah,
and higher.
Her star's rising too, which is very cool. And totally deserved. But yeah, I think that felt like such a letdown. And honestly, I think a lot of people were really let down by Annihilation, that got mired in adaptation questions of like, has this ruined the source material type of thing. I feel like the more latitude and budget he's gotten, the sort of more disappointed people seem to be with the output.
Yeah.
But I think that Sunshine is still really, really underrated and underseen, kind of undercelebrated.
Hugely.
I meet people who watch sci-fi movies all the time who have never heard of it or seen it, that it's been sort of like off their radar. And then when they do see it, they're like, why is everyone in this movie just like enormously famous? A huge Murderers Row ensemble movie. So I don't know what that's about, but like, I think that and Ex Machina will be returned to, because even my students now, like in 2024, I feel like plenty of them have never seen Ex Machina. Like, it's already old enough, and I'm sure you're getting this with a lot of the films that you're talking about for this series. Like, it's already old enough that it's evaded younger audiences, especially who are part of that A24, like, acolyte kind of crew.
Yeah. They've got the hats.
Yeah. They have the merch.
They've got the tote bags. I love a tote.
Totally. Though if A24 is listening, I will totally contribute to your next horror themed cookbook. Fucked that one up.
Can I just say, just follow Veronica's Instagram for her impeccable food creating tastes and consuming tastes, both of which are some of my favorite things on the internet. And I often I'll just go, what is that, or where is that, or oh my god, I'm so hungry, is usually three key things that I flag with her as she's doing it. So yeah, no, it is interesting, because I think also at this time there are these huge brands. I think it's also sort of, it's about to happen again with Neon, like the earliest Neon stuff is now sort of this presence in the film, you know, independent cinema environment. And things are going to start popping up on this project that are there. And I feel like A24 is like, I when I hear people get really in the bag for it, I'm kind of like, cool. All right.
Yeah. It's so weird. Somehow we managed not to get really excited about the Focus Features bubbles, even though those used to precede some of the most, the biggest bangers of my like
Paramount Vantage. Paramount Vantage. I was like, shit, let's go, Eric Fellner. I'm very excited for some producers then. I want to quickly, before we go on to Alicia and Oscar, I want to talk about Domhnall Gleeson, who I think is just a terrific and completely underrated actor. Decade project, I got to speak about one of my favorite movies that he's ever done, which is About Time.
People love that movie.
I think it's a really, again, just a really terrific and understated and small and special little movie. A heartbreaking thing, lots of good tears. At this time, I want to go back. Black Mirror. Black Mirror is 2011, so we're a couple of years.
Okay.
In that corridor.
We're there. Yeah.
But Domhnall Gleeson stars in an episode of Black Mirror. He's in Dread from 2012 as one of the bad guys. He's a Weasley in the Harry Potter, so he's kicking goals there. Mm-hmm. But in this corridor, he makes About Time, makes Frank, which is another movie.
Oh, I love Frank. Love Frank.
Frank's a great movie. He's in Calvary, which is my favorite movie of this year. I think it's just a sensational movie starring his dad, Brendan Gleeson. He's then in Angelina Jolie's film Unbroken. He's then in Brooklyn, which is terrific, in 2015. And then
so good.
And then he jumps into the Star Warses, you know. So he's mm-hmm. it's really huge, and he's got a terrific like bunch, a patch of movies. But he's just a guy who like is just constantly working, popping up on TV, movie, film clips, you name it. But I think at this time it was like, this is another one of those that like, this guy is such an emerging talent. And I still don't quite think he's ever gotten his flowers really for anything.
No.
He's mm-hmm. just great. He's going to be one of those guys that in like 10 years, people are like, holy shit, we just missed it. We missed mm-hmm. this. He'll do something great, you know, in his, you know, late 40s as kind of his dad did. He'll do something sensational. Mm-hmm. People will be like, oh, there's like 100 Domhnall Gleeson performances. Yeah, he's great. He's a terrific actor.
You're making a great plug for a potential Domhnall Gleeson like retrospective. I feel like that would be amazing.
Let's do it. Like that, even this period is insane. Like he's,
yeah,
like he's in some he's in the Harry Potters, which is some of the highest grossing movies of all time. He's in Star Wars: The Force Awakens, which is one of the highest grossing movies of all time. He's in The Revenant, which won Best Picture, and he's in American Made. He's in Mother. He's like he's jumping around.
Yeah,
a very adorable Peter Rabbit, great kids movie that you know I'm now very familiar with. I'm more familiar with than I would have preferred, but he's got there's a lot of terrific stuff that he's been a part of, and I think he's excellent. Whereas you get Alicia, who, I mean. I'm just going back to this particular part of her career. She's got, it's pretty crazy. She comes in with, you know, I think A Royal Affair is a huge one. That's 2012. Yep. Anna Karenina, The Fifth Estate. She's then in, she's in Testament of Youth. She's in an Aussie crime flick called Son of a Gun in this same year. She then goes into Man from U.N.C.L.E., which I think she's fantastic in. Danish Girl is where she wins her Oscar in 2015. Mm-hmm. She's then in a Bourne movie. She's in like a bunch of
terrible movies.
Terrible movie.
She's not good. Yeah, it's not good.
Terrible movie. She's not.
That's
good
another one where it's like, this is not an analyst. Like, it's just not. She's not. She might get coffee, but she's not an analyst.
She's not an analyst. No. And she then does Tomb Raider, and everyone's like, oh, cool. Like, maybe she's doing something. But then she's had, I think, because of being in having a family with one Michael Fassbender.
Right.
She's kind of like not done a great deal. She did the Green
on the way of, Eva Mendes.
Exactly.
We've lost her.
Oh, man. But you know what? That couple is so adorable, and he is so goddamn sweet that it's just, it's disgusting how much they love each other, those two. It's gross. Mm-hmm. It's you know, it's like when you see people really in love. I've been complimented on that with my own wife sometimes. People are like, oh, you two are just disgusting. I'm like, thank you.
The ultimate compliment.
It's good. But yeah, she's kind of not like, she was in Irma Vep, the miniseries in 2022.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But there's not, I don't know if post Danish Girl Academy Award winning fame we've even gotten close to what she can do. I don't think we have. I think out of this trio, the guy that's standing so tall is Oscar Isaac.
Yes.
I mean, his career at this time, and then all the way up, obviously, into the Dunes, et cetera, he's just continuing to crush it, and is my fan favorite to be cast as Vincent Hanna in the Heat 2 movie.
That's a great idea.
I would
that's
really
a great
like him
idea.
To be older. I mean, he's like sort of similar age to Pacino was when he made the first movie. I'm like, that's Pacino.
Yeah.
If you need a Pacino type, just watch A Most Violent Year, made in 2014 as well. You've got the guy. He's here. That's him.
He's so versatile. And I think it would be easy to watch this film for the first time and be super surprised at his characterization and be like, oh my God, like Oscar Isaac got gains and he has a beard and like,
and shaves his beautiful hair,
you know, that kind of like broiness, like optimization, bro kind of thing feels
so,
so much more 2024.
It's
yeah,
2024,
exactly.
Like that, like I only drink shakes.
Yes, like, it's green juice, but then I'm like pounding vodka at night, or it's probably tequila, I don't know. And then like thinking you're saying really smart things, but you're just saying self contradictory things about Pollock paintings and that characterization, but also the Caleb characterization, I think, is like so contemporary, that sense of like an incel. I remember seeing the film in 2014 and being like, feeling a lot of sympathy for the Caleb character, particularly at the end of the film, obviously.
Yes.
But as, and just a sympathy for the difficulty of navigating a kind of weird, like aspirational, not a friendship. Like I'm at my mentor's house. I hope he likes me. I'm failing. I'm not social, you know, all of that kind of awkwardness that he carries so well.
That question that Ava asks him, like, are you friends? And he's like, yeah. No, like it's just this great series of mind readings from Donald. I hope to be. It takes time. And just that awkwardness. It's like that he's got,
so
like,
funny.
That's why he's so perfect for this role, is because he can
totally
be really locked in and hypnotized and very easily, almost like people can put him into sort of like this trance state. He kind of gets entranced by the characters. But that moment is such a like people pleasy thing, and he's got like dark edges, so he can do lots of things like that, but I think he's like his dimensions, and he's like very sweet. And then, you know, he goes out and Oscar Isaac's sweating in a tank top, just like, you know, ripping bicep curls, and you're just like, bless your
Amazing.
Heart Oscar Isaac.
I know, it's incredible. And he brings a likability to that character that just persists throughout. And it helps that he has a great drunk performance. I'm a sucker for a good drunk performance from an actor. I just rewatched Mayor of Easttown, and Evan Peters' drunk scene in that is one of my all-time favorites.
20 out of 10. And great series, man, a lot.
Yeah, Evan really holds up.
Evan Peters and Domhnall Gleeson, very similarly underrated guys.
Agree.
Like, and have both immense versatility, can both do all the things we're talking about, but just like, I do. Oscar Isaac's drunk performance, he's just, I mean, special.
Those Fusters. That's so funny. I feel like the most famous guy who's the same as Donald Gleason and maybe Evan Peters to some extent is Paul Dano. Paul Dano?
Yeah,
I actually don't know which way it goes, but.
Yeah.
It's like if Gleason got his There Will Be Blood, then maybe we would see, like,
then we'd have a different trajectory. People,
right
now we're getting his like Star Warsy, where he's playing bad British villain kind of stuff, and it's like,
yeah,
man, I wish he got some justice. You know,
right.
You're like, it's like you're clearly having fun, and you clearly understand the assignment that this is ultimately a children's movie, so you just have your fun like you would with Peter Rabbit. But yeah, he needs that. He needs to have a method actor scream in his face that he abandoned his child, and then we can move on. But whereas Oscar Isaac, you know, just going back, like there's some like silly ones like Moon Knight, obviously, but I love him as a voice actor in Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Scenes from a Marriage brought us the great I'm going to smell Jessica Chastain's underarm gif, which is a gift.
I can't recover from it ever.
I just want to describe, this is where sometimes I wish I recorded every show for video too. Veronica just looked off into the middle distance and put her hand on her, put her fingertips, her index finger on her head, just like, cannot compute.
It's my version of the Antonio Banderas like kissing my fingers gif, basically. It sends me to the moon. I mean
it's really my energy, and that's what I'm aspiring to in life.
Gosh.
And I just, it's good stuff. It's really the best stuff, to be honest. But like Scenes from a Marriage, Dune, Card Counter, which I think is excellent, and he is excellent in it. He does the Star Wars, so there's all that stuff that's happening. He makes a terrific film, Triple Frontier, which I think is pretty underrated, and he's great in it. And then you just keep going back, and there's just all these, it's like a cavalcade of bangers. He does pop up in Annihilation, but he's just, you know, there's a few kind of big ones that kind of probably he's like, ugh, you know, the X-Men Apocalypse was really bad. I don't think he's necessarily bad. I think the entire movie's bad, but you've got then like A Most Violent Year, Inside Llewyn Davis, obviously, that he gets Academy Award nominations for, which is a huge movie, and he is so special in. And yeah, I just think his resume is just nuts. Like, you know, on IMDb right now, he's known for, which is very lovely, he's known for Ex Machina, Inside Llewyn Davis, A Most Violent Year, and Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi. Wow. They are his top movies that are interactive.
Not bad.
I'm like, that's good. If Drive could just sneak in to that fourth slot, it would just, it would make something else. But he's like a guy who's got projects coming out of his ears. Mm-hmm. He's very special.
Yeah, I have to go back and watch Sucker Punch, because in scanning the Wikipedia, I realized that he actually plays an orderly in a lot of makeup in the 2011 film. But yeah, I actually like love Sucker Punch, so I would be thrilled to revisit.
Can I go
with
to bat
eyes peeled for him?
Can I go to bat for another pre-Drive couple of films? First is a really terrific Australian film called Balibo, about starring Anthony LaPaglia, which is really terrific. If you haven't seen it, I'll just try and sort of get the blurb. It's about a war correspondent traveling to East Timor to investigate the murder of the Balibo Five, which is really, it's a really terrific movie, great Aussie flick. I think his performance in Robin Hood, which is overall a big kind of bloated movie, his performance as Prince John in that movie is off the chain. He is going for it. Like Ridley Scott just said, go for it, son. And he understood the assignment. He really crushed it in Robin Hood. So if you just want Oscar Isaac unhinged, Robin Hood may be in his top three performances of all time. So yeah, he has he's kind of like really establishing himself there.
Oh my God, the facial hair.
Yes.
It's like he looks like he's in the Backstreet Boys.
He does.
It's amazing.
It is so, so good. All right. So the one thing that I want to touch on just before we get to like Sliding Doors and things like that, because there's one person we haven't talked about, is Sonoya Mizuno, who plays Kyoko, is really, really fantastic. She's unsurprisingly an English Japanese model ballet dancer. If you saw her immediately, you're like, this, she's a beautiful creature, and the nicest possible way I can say that, because she's like, if she was playing an analyst, you're like, this lady does ballet, like there's no way would be an analyst, but she's perfect for this movie. She's had, again, I think she might have had like low-key a really killer run after this. Like she's in La La Land after this, which is a huge movie. She's in Beauty and the Beast. She's in Annihilation. And she's later in like Men. She's in House of the Dragon for 5 episodes. She pops up in Civil War as well. She's also in Crazy Rich Asians. Like she's made a bunch of movies. But she in this movie like essentially has a completely wordless performance and completely is such a great foil for Oscar Isaac's dude bro-ness. And like the movie, I feel like, opens, because we're going to get into deep spoiler territory, when you find out that she's like an android, when she's like a fembot, you know, the iPhone 1 versus Alicia Vikander's, you know, iPhone 13, you know, like she's like, she is so fantastic. And again, the whole characterization and the bait and switch of him just going, yeah, I get it, because she doesn't speak, she's Chinese, she doesn't speak the language, you know, she's just, you know, it's my firewall. Like the way he talks about a person, language barrier being a firewall, again, peak bro, doing, you know, bicep curls, drinking juice. I think she's really beautiful and terrific in this movie, and just has a great presence, because she's that unexpected fourth character that like like in this little weird triangle, she's this other entity that is hard to grasp.
Yeah, the film links her to some of its weirder inclusions.
Yes.
And I love a moment when Caleb bizarrely starts like slicing into his own arm in the bathroom mirror in his kind of underground bunker room. And he's sort of exploring, he's interrogating his own body. He's exploring his own humanness. And we cut from that, which is kind of extended, and there's like loud, distorted music happening over it, but like a dialogue-less scene. But the way it ends is a cut to Kyoko looking at the monitor. And we don't see the monitor. Like, we don't get a reverse shot from her POV to confirm that she's actually watching footage of what he's doing. But it's implied. And I love that it's only implied. Like, it's implied at most. Yes. And just the idea that she might be sort of like clicking around on a monitor, or she might have computer access or be interested in something and reacting to something, but that we don't get to actually know what her reactions are. It's just one of the film's mysteries. And I think it's because of those mysteries that it's such a good movie. You know, yes. Without those, it would just be too pat, but it sort of gives us that. And then also that extended, strange encounter, something like a conversation that she has with Ava's character at the end of the film, some kind of consultation that they have together. That, again, like, that is, as you were saying,
I think you wrote about it so beautifully, where I want to actually go and find the passage where you say, "The moment in the hallway, in its partiality and mysteriousness, has no earlier model. Amid all the film's unmaskings and sexual cliches, this is the mutual recognition between Ava and Kyoko is, oh, sorry, the mutual recognition between Ava and Kyoko is the film's greatest accomplishment, the true singularity." Like, these two things. And I also love how high-minded it is and how elliptical and right. Yeah. But I also love... Have you ever like been pissed off with Google or Siri when you're just asking them for something basic and you're like, "God damn it, Siri, like play Travis Scott Utopia on Spotify," and it just is like, something will happen and it'll be like playing you some random, and you're like, "No, like that wasn't hard. I was clear." That's also in the energy between Oscar Isaac's Nathan and Kyoko. Like, she's the inferior model that I can't give my voice recognition stuff. So I was watching it last night and I was like, that's so funny how pissed off he is that she can't do the simple tasks
right
assigned to her. So it's almost like this like lashing that he's giving himself. Like, there's a bit of like sadomasochism about his creations.
Right.
Like, he's angry,
right.
And the anger manifests because he couldn't create a better model. And all she can now do is be relegated to this lower level task, and that she can't even perform.
That's such an interesting idea, that like in his frustration with her, there's some kind of prediction of our own really mundane frustrations with everyday technology.
Yeah.
And that it's really like it loops back to him. Like, yes. What was I thinking when I programmed you? Though it's obvious that he sort of curtailed his programming to produce this like wordless, like really compliant kind of model, as opposed to the like high functioning wetware that Ava has.
Yeah. He's like, "I need you to get me drinks, clean up after me, and also really rip out the sickest dance moves of all time." Like,
she's like a sexy Roomba. Like, there's nothing, there's no there. But sometimes you just want someone to dance with. Like, I totally get it.
I mean, this is all that the overlords have to do to get us these sexy Roombas that just are wordless and will, you know, dance with, be like just strikingly beautiful, clean you up. I mean, they're going to take over. It's happening. It's going to happen to us. All right. In the wrap up, I like to sort of like talk about a little bit of kind of Sliding Doors. There's a couple of bits of trivia which are really cool. The first thing is, it is called the Juve Landscape Hotel in Norway.
Okay, which, Norway.
So I quickly Googled that while we were talking, because I was like, "Oh, that's so fantastic. Must do that."
Yeah, and you can do your podcast team retreat.
Oh my God. You're invited if we go to the Juve Hotel in Norway. The only barrier for entry, have you practiced the dance from Ex Machina? Of course we have. Alex Garland, at the time when people were talking to him about how he felt this film being situated, he was just like, "This is a 10 minutes from now movie," which I really like that description. And he was just like, "I feel like," and especially now 10 years later, that this is a 10 minutes from now something. Because, you know, you see this, the studies at Boston Dynamics, I think it's even as recently as the last couple of weeks, excuse me, they programmed sort of a robot at Boston Dynamics to perform a menial task, like a factory worker's task. And that's nothing to diminish people who are working in a factory, because they have to. You got to do what you got to do. I'm someone who worked in a factory after high school to make money. but they basically programmed to do these menial tasks where they were just like picking up or picking and packing a box. Mm-hmm. And the robot's level of sentience realized that they were getting, I think they programmed it like, this is how you're incentivized. You're going to get X amount of dollars an hour. The robot killed itself. It just did the mathematics in its head of how much it would have to work for the amount of money and immediately stopped working and fell down. And I'm like,
oh my God.
I'm like, yeah, Ali, I think at the time when Alex Garland was saying 10 minutes from now, I know that this is like a weird thing to say, but like 10 years later, it feels like it's a minute from now. Like it's mm-hmm. 1 minute away, like one mm-hmm. year in time, this is become mm-hmm. pretty crazy. I do like this. Oscar Isaac in an interview said that his characterization of Nathan was based on the chess champion, Bobby Fischer, and Stanley Kubrick.
Right.
Which I think is...
Kubrick wishes, right?
Has the right level of horniness that is simmering, if not boiling, underneath Stanley Kubrick's obsessiveness. But yeah, absolutely, he wishes. So... Yeah, it's that there are a couple of bits of, but there's no, you know, in this movie, I guess in big movies, there's usually sliding doors moments. Who else was going to be cast? Were there other filmmakers here? But, you know, in the A24 of it all, it was always Alex Garland. He was the writer director mm-hmm. right from the outset. It seems like all these actors were his first choices, and mm-hmm. you can see that they've worked with him in parts later. But yeah, I think that 10 years later, Ex Machina is just, it's getting closer and closer to the weird nexus of our current reality with AI and, you know, generative, you know, language models and ChatGPT and all these kind of things. It feels like this is just close enough to the reality. It, right from the outset, it's that weird sense of sci-fi where it was like so close you could smell it. Like there wasn't, mm-hmm. it's not like 100 years into the future or 10 years mm-hmm. into the future. It was like, this could happen right at this minute and maybe be repressed by some military organization to take it away from us, you know?
Yeah. And that sense of like gender that's at the heart of it, I think is so important to keep in mind, even with something like ChatGPT, which feels really neutered and neutral.
Yes.
I used to date someone who would ask Siri to set an alarm for like a nap alarm. And I thought this was the most insidious fucking thing. Like, it's like, there's something about it. I'm sure it was in concert with a lot of other things, but it was just sort of like, you know, what does it mean that you're asking your feminized like phone helper to like wake you up? And just like the biotech of it also was like super creepy to me. But I think I want to shout out an article that came out in 2017.
Sorry. That was almost too good. I just need to just a bit of air. Okay, let's go back to it.
I confess. There's this article that when I taught Ex Machina, when I used to teach a sci-fi class, I loved assigning it with some other kind of gender and technology or even dating app related readings. But there's a great non-dating app, more AI related article. It was a cover story of Wired in October 2017, written by Alex Marr, where she went and kind of like hung out with, I want to say lived with, but they weren't really living together, just sort of hung out with Hiroshi Ishiguro, who builds androids. And it's this exploration of like his android making practice. Some of the models are based on his own like young daughter at the time.
Oh, God.
And one of the like, you know, dark reveals of this article is that eventually, because it was so resembled his daughter, it was actually modeled like they used her body as a mold. Yeah. They came to find out that some of the workers in the lab were too attached to the model, and that there became a rule that they couldn't work alone in the lab with her. And just like, it's not just a movie, you know, like these sorts of consequences.
Talk about the Uncanny Valley.
100%. Like, yeah.
God. The Uncanny Valley, for folks who are listening, it's the best way I can describe it is the Robert Zemeckis film, so Beowulf, right? So they're making photorealistic human being avatars in that movie, but they're animated, and you can look at them and they look so photoreal and they look like people. And, you know, even though it's like Ray Winston as Beowulf, it's like it's a younger Chris Hemsworthified Ray Winston. But when you look at the eyes, you can see that there's like a soullessness, there's a blankness, it's a canvas. It's more like you're looking into a glass eye. There's something, there's no like penetrating humanity underneath it. And that uncanny valley is that idea that sort of in like whatever like limbic system in our brain that says like that is not a real person or that thing is not real. It's like the subtlest of detection, the highest level of detection that we still have with like special effects and things like that to this day, where you look at it and you say there is something about that that's not real, and it's a danger protection mechanism that is built into our organic machines that we have. And so the pursuit for AI to have like realistic humanoid potential is the protection device that seems to be like a failsafe in our own operating system. Is the uncanny valley is always there to tell us that they're not real. And that is so scary that like that these guys who are working with it every day, that line is blurred between what is real and what is not.
Totally. I mean, it's so apt that the uncanny valley like picks up on the language theorized by Freud, the uncanny, which is itself based on the E.T.A. Hoffman story about a guy falling in love with like a doll woman. So it all kind of like these stories, as someone who has a Velveteen Rabbit tattoo, like these stories of having real feelings for inanimate kind of figures are everywhere with a lot of different kind of tones. But I think Ex Machina really gets at the relatability of that desire to connect without necessarily totally judging it, but also reveals the pitfalls of trusting your technology a little bit too much.
Yeah. Oh my God. This has been such a great chat. Ex Machina in 10 years has only gotten scarier and more scarily real. It continues to have a place, like unlike some other 10-year-old movies, which are harder to get your hands on. Ex Machina seems like it's around. It seems like even if people haven't heard of it, you can say, just look up Ex Machina, and you don't really know. I wouldn't know off the top of my head what streaming service you'd be able to get it, but it's widely available. Still, you can sort of purchase it on an Apple or an Amazon or Google or YouTube or whatever the case may be. And I think Alex Garland being out in the media and doing Civil War again in another A24 movie as it is, it's probably much easier to get. But man, thank you so much. This has been so fun, Veronica, talking. It's always a complete blast and it goes absolutely every place that I would hope for. It's such a blast to revisit this with you. And I'm so glad that this one, particularly to hear firstly that it's a, like a great sci-fi, like one of my favorite film courses I ever did at university was a sci-fi film course. And it feels like some of the choices in sci-fi film, like when you've got to dive into sci-fi history, they're very obvious. And then there's sort of like 80s stuff where you sort of see how it breaks into the mainstream because it had always been kind of like B, and it breaks into the mainstream and it becomes like a huge tenet of our culture and big sci-fi movies. But if I was programming myself like something in there, I think Ex Machina is fascinating because it is ultimately science fiction. I had a great professor who used to call science fiction the vicious prosthesis. Was his like mini thesis for all science fiction. And what that means is, you know, a prosthesis meaning a prosthetic. And he was using things like, you know, Luke Skywalker's hand, you know, that was a symbol of like that he's got a robotic hand. And the less that he's in touch with his humanity, the more that he's in touch potentially with the darker impulses of his soul. And use that as a, even though Star Wars is not technically a sci-fi, but like vicious prosthesis, the things that we create ultimately eat us, you know, Blade Runner, Ex Machina is one of these, you know, more contemporary versions. It's like, and so I love anytime I see sci-fi that is really directly entangled and addressing that vicious prosthesis thesis of all sci-fi, I'm like, that's the good stuff. And so for me, this is like a great movie and I'm so glad that you enjoyed it and got to write so beautifully about it. I'll make sure I link your great article. And you know, for me, the highlight of this conversation is going to be a gesture of you responding to Oscar Isaac smelling Jessica Chastain's underarm almost more than any other part of the conversation.
I could do an hour on that, like, honestly. When you do your GIF series, we'll get right into that.
Oh my God, that's a fun one. That's a fun, could be a fun one for Brightwall. Movie GIFs and what they mean to us. Look, sensational movie. Great to talk to you as always. Any like fresh plugs because this one's going to go on our Patreon early, but any sort of fresh and then sort of evergreen plugs that you want to give, I would love you to share, please.
You can find the Brightwall Dark Room podcast at all the regular places. You can find me still on Twitter at Gudomako. You can find my cake Instagram on Instagram at GlutenMako, M-A-K-O. And I will say that I just recorded a commentary for Steven Shainberg's Secretary. The new HD Blu-ray release from Imprint Media is coming out in June, so you can give that a pre-order.
Absolutely. The batch of the century in Imprint. I'm such a big Imprint person in that batch. Myself, Maria Lewis, Jen Johans, Travis Woods, Jim Hempel, and Veronica doing Secretary. We were just talking about it before we started recording. I'm so excited. I actually demanded to Veronica that it had to be the horniest commentary ever. And she said she charted a course between thirsty and academic. And I said, that's your memoir. So in advance of your memoir, thirsty and academic, in many years time, I can't wait to get my hands on that, but you're the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.